This is the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Welcome. Ahead this hour, have we reached a turning point with the opioid crisis? There were fewer overdose deaths across Pennsylvania last year, but the reality is, even as the numbers look somewhat better, thousands of people still lost their lives. Aubrey Whelan of the Philadelphia Inquirer will have the latest. Also, Eagles preseason is underway. Inquirer sports columnist Mike Sielski will be along with an early look at the Birds. But today's show begins on a dark note with a discussion about the Boy Scouts of America, an institution beloved by many, but whose reputation is in tatters.
There is a crisis in the Boy Scouts, and there has been for many years, many decades, in fact, since the early 1900s.
Philadelphia attorney Stuart Eisenberg is representing a Luzerne County man who says he was sexually abused by a scout leader when he was 12 years old. A story diametrically opposed to the wholesome image of camping, community service, and the Pinewood Derby, scouting activities designed to build character and have fun. Eisenberg helped to form a group called Abused in Scouting, and he says hundreds of men have come forward to say they too were sexually abused as boys by Boy Scout leaders, allegations which have shaken the Scouts to the core. If you'd like to share your thoughts, you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. WHYY's Nick Pugliese has been covering this story, and he joins us now. Welcome back, Nick.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's begin by talking about the Luzerne County man known only as SD. Do we know more about his story?
We know only what's been alleged in the lawsuit, which is that he was 12 or 13 at the time the abuse started. This was in the mid-70s. He would go on camping trips or other activities, and at that time there's an assistant scoutmaster who did a number of horrific things, including plying him with drugs and alcohol, and the suit alleges abused him hundreds of times from the time he was 12 to 17.
Stories like SD's are apparently too many to count. Tell us about the group called Abused in Scouting. What is it? How did it come together?
So it's a consortium of attorneys that actually, well, they came together to try to solicit business. That sounds more cynical than it is. Yeah. There was reports last year that the Boy Scouts were considering filing for bankruptcy, and this group of attorneys said that caused them to come together. There's some urgency behind this, and they started running ads on TV. And these are personal injury attorneys. This ad was not high quality. It's sort of the stuff that runs late at night, but it essentially says, if you're abused in scouting, you're not alone. Here's a number you can call. And about 800 people reached out to this group of attorneys since February.
Fair number from Pennsylvania and New Jersey?
There's 40 from Pennsylvania, I'm told, about 20 from New Jersey. And nationwide, they range in age from 14 years old to 88. Yeah. So it's a pretty wide swath.
As Stuart Eisenberg said earlier, this crisis has been ongoing in the Boy Scouts for many years. We heard back in April that leadership kept what were called perversion files, or ineligible volunteer files, some of which dated back nearly a century. Do we know what these files consisted of?
Yes, so these are allegations of abuse. Not all of them have been substantiated, but the Boy Scouts kept them to try to weed out the bad apples. It was their first line of offense against volunteers that had, didn't meet their moral standards. It wasn't just abuse, but the ones called the perversion files were a paper trail of abuse. And these have things like, police reports, witness statements, complaints from parents, news clippings of this.
But this was all after the fact.
These were
people who were in scouting as leaders and then were discovered to have allegedly perpetrated.
That's correct. And the Boy Scouts wanted to use these files and did in many cases to prevent people from serving who had these issues and credible allegations. But a lot of times they were circumvented in a number of ways. Anything from volunteers lying about their biographical information to get back in, or clerical errors, like it wasn't checked when a new volunteer came in, to things like the Boy Scouts letting people come back in, or, sort of forgiving them, saying they're on probation and they won't do it again. And that's what infuriates so many people, that and is really tough to wrap your head around, that these files exist and in many cases there wasn't enough done to prevent this abuse happening again.
Nick, this scandal threatens to overshadow even that which engulfs the Catholic Church in terms of sheer numbers. I'd seen that. Is that the case?
It's hard to get a full reckoning in either case. Just some numbers to put this in perspective. Again, we mentioned there's about 800 new allegations that have come forward, according to the attorneys, from this abused and scouting advertising campaign. And it was interesting. Earlier this year, there was an attorney retained by the Scouts to do an audit of the perversion files going back many decades. And that's probably the most full accounting we have thus far. And she testified in court that there's nearly 8,000 suspected abusers nationwide and over 12,000 victims. Those numbers are shocking. Mm-hmm. To put in perspective, the Pennsylvania grand jury report that came out of the Catholic Church last summer said just in Pennsylvania there was 300 Catholic priests and 1,000 child victims of abuse in Pennsylvania. So in neither case do experts think everyone who was abused has come forward. There's a lot of people out there that haven't spoken up. It seems almost certain. And those numbers, again, are just Pennsylvania. So I just think about the numbers in the rest of the country as well.
Possibly the tip of the iceberg. Nick, it has in the past been tough for victims to pursue claims legally because of statutes of limitation.
Yes. So specifically civil statute of limitations where you claim you have a personal injury, damages, you know, tons of folks who suffered abuse as children develop problems later on from substance abuse to depression to just having difficulty in various ways. And when you discover that abuse and you link it to your, experiences as a child, you want to be able to get compensation, get a semblance of justice in court, be able to confront your accuser. And a lot of states have statute of limitations that time bar it, that say you can only do so within 2 years of a triggering event, typically the abuse. So in a lot of states, it's been hard for folks oftentimes who don't come forward for decades to actually pursue a civil claim.
Well, let's talk about Pennsylvania. At this point, you can only go to court for a child sex abuse claims if you do so before the age of 30.
Correct.
But a recent case in Pennsylvania Superior Court could prove a game changer. Tell us about that.
This is an interesting one. It's sort of early in the story, but there was a lawsuit filed against the Diocese of Altoona Johnstown, and that alleged that a woman who had suffered abuse as a child many decades ago, she said she didn't have any reason to suspect a cover-up and a conspiracy by the church until a grand jury report came out of her diocese. And that's really what should have started the two-year window where she could bring a claim. And a three-judge panel agreed with her. And if that is upheld in the Superior Court and potentially tested at the state Supreme Court level, that could be the new law of the land, even though the legislature has not acted to make a more permissive statute of limitation for victims.
So according to the Superior Court ruling, if it's found that an organization fraudulently covers up abuse, the alleged victims could still have the right to sue.
Could still. And it's the attorneys in the abuse and scouting case with the Luzerne County man are trying to draw parallels between the church and the Boy Scouts. There was no grand jury report documenting abuse in the Boy Scouts. So it's sort of, we'll just have to see how it plays out and whether they can successfully make an analogy to the new Boy Scouts case.
So quickly, you were on the roundup in May to talk about a new law in New Jersey extending the statute of limitations for sex abuse survivors for civil lawsuits. It's starting in December. It's no longer just age 20 or 2 years after the first realization of abuse caused harm. Under the new statute, it'll be up to 55 or within 7 years. So there is progress moving ahead in some
absolutely
states.
And very importantly, there starting December 1st, no matter when your alleged abuse occurred, you have a 2 year window in New Jersey to bring a civil case. So that's huge for victims that were previously barred from the statute of limitations.
Okay. The Boy Scouts of America was granted a charter by Congress in 1916. It is a nonprofit which receives federal subsidies. Lawyers with the Abused and Scouting Group now want Congress to get involved. How so, Nick?
They want Congress to call hearings, to have victims testify, to try to elicit more information from the Scouts than I think attorneys have been successful in doing in individual cases. as far as I'm aware, Congress has not said they would do anything like that. So, and there's other avenues for these attorneys to go down, but their point is the Boy Scouts hold a privileged position as a nonprofit due to this congressional charter dating back over 100 years. So they think it's Congress's responsibility to do something.
There's now talk of bankruptcy, perhaps, for the Scouts?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, there was reports that emerged late last year that the Boy Scouts were considering filing for bankruptcy, and that's very much related to the allegations that have come forward. It's expensive to defend yourself from cases like this. Settlements, even if it doesn't go to a jury, can be very expensive. And there's been dwindling membership, I think, in part due to concerns over these abuse allegations going back some time. So we don't know yet what's going to happen with that. And the Boy Scouts have been tight-lipped about what their, you know, actual plans are. They have not filed for bankruptcy at this point in time.
You've reached out to the Boy Scouts. Have they instituted safeguards to ensure abuse does not happen to any other boy or girls? Girls are now part of the Boy Scouts of America. I think it's just called Scouts of America now.
Yes, absolutely they have. And we should be very upfront about that. So they have, over a decade ago now, I think, instituted criminal background checks for all new volunteers. They have instituted a policy where scout leaders and children can never be one-on-one in any interaction, even online or through texting. They really want to cut down on any appearances or situations where that sort of thing could happen. They have a policy where volunteers are kicked out on the first allegation of abuse, even a suspicion of abuse. So, and we've spoken to a few parents since the story came out last week, and at least a few of them have said that they feel these safeguards are enough, and they feel safe with their kids and the Scouts at this point in time.
Yeah, Nick, you and a fellow WHYY reporter, Hima Kondi, you know, are currently working on this project, reaching out to parents, trying to get a sense of their reaction to the crisis. So some feel, okay, this, you know, the Boy Scouts are moving in the right direction. But still, is there an emotional piece to your conversations with these parents?
Absolutely. So in addition to what I said, there are the parents I spoke to still are taking steps that maybe they wouldn't have 10, 20 years ago. One woman I spoke to actually runs a child advocacy center here in Pennsylvania, so she's very familiar with the issues of violence against children, specifically sexual violence against children. And she said, you know, she wanted her son to participate in the Scouts. He's very interested in science and the outdoors, and that's not something that she necessarily could, you know, teach him on her own. But to protect him, she goes to every meeting. She doesn't allow him to go off with parents that he doesn't know. And so it's a compromise now, a little more awareness on her part.
All right, we'll watch for your story. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
WHYY's Nick Pugliese. And coming up here on the WHYY Radio Times Regional Roundup, an update on the opioid crisis. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. For those who are grappling with the agony of a loved one suffering drug addiction, there is a glimmer of hope. The number of people who died from overdose dropped a full 18% across the state of Pennsylvania last year, the first drop in that number in 5 years. Encouraging news, but still, the number of people who did lose their lives because of drug use last year was well over 4,400. Most of these cases were opioid-related, and as Governor Wolf indicated, there is much more to be done, saying, quote, "You don't see a mission accomplished sign here." We're going to spend the next 20 minutes talking about the work that is being done and the challenges that remain. Here's our email address, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us if you'd like to join the conversation at WHYY Radio Times. Joining us in studio is Aubrey Wheeler, reporter with the Philadelphia Inquirer, who's done extensive coverage of the opioid crisis. Good to have you back with us on Radio Times, Aubrey.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's begin with the good news. The number of overdose deaths in Pennsylvania has fallen. Aubrey, what do we know that is contributing to the decline?
Yeah. Yeah, it was an 18% drop from last year. But, you know, some of the statistics, I mean, again, it's a crisis that's so staggering in its scope that, you know, that means 12 people are dying a day in Pennsylvania still. And fentanyl is particularly, is affecting the crisis in a lot of ways. There were 70% of the deaths in 2018 were from fentanyl. I think in terms of what's been contributing to the drop, definitely increased access to medication-assisted treatment, access to Narcan or naloxone, the overdose-reversing drug. There've been a lot of efforts across the state to really flood communities that are particularly hard hit with Narcan, and it seems to have worked in a number of places, including in Philadelphia. Kensington in Philly saw a pretty big drop this year, which is really encouraging. Yeah. So,
Philadelphia has mirrored the state in seeing fewer deaths due to overdose, 1,116 people, down from over 1,200 in 2017, but still, Aubrey, a devastating number. And as you referenced before, fentanyl is at the heart of this.
Yes.
Fentanyl use disproportionately affects one age group?
Yes, a couple age groups, 15 to 24 and I think 25 to 34.
So the young.
Yes, the young. Yeah. I think their overdose rates from fentanyl in particular are a little bit higher than the statewide average. It's especially in Philadelphia, it's contaminated most of the drug supply, most of the heroin supply, that is. Your chances of getting pure heroin in Philadelphia are slim.
Yeah, and fentanyl, of course, increases the likelihood that you a user would overdose and even die. But in addition to this, Aubrey, your column on Friday was titled "A Hidden Danger of Addiction: Infection." Infections which result from intravenous drug use are on the rise in Philly, and again as a direct result of fentanyl.
Yes, fentanyl is also it has a shorter half life than heroin. So if you're taking heroin and you're addicted to heroin, you're going to be injecting maybe a couple times a day. But fentanyl sends you into withdrawal faster. So
you're injecting more.
You're injecting multiple times a day. Yeah, and if you don't have enough clean needles to change a needle out every time you're injecting, that's an overdose. An infection risk. Hepatitis C infections, hepatitis A infections, HIV infections are rising around the state. But also in Philly, we're seeing increases in stuff like group A strep, invasive group A strep, which is like a skin infection that when it enters the bloodstream can become very, very dangerous. And also endocarditis, which is an infection of the valves of the heart.
Mm. How much is this stressing the city health system?
Certainly treating infections is a lot more complicated than treating an overdose. And it's very difficult for people in addiction to kind of think about going to the hospital over this, even though it's life-threatening, it's really scary. But, especially with fentanyl, again, with that shorter half-life, people get really worried about entering withdrawal. So often, people will there was a survey I cited in that story of heroin users in I think it was Massachusetts and in Sacramento, where people were saying that, many people who responded to the survey said that they had suffered a skin infection but waited weeks to go to the hospital because they were afraid they were going to go into withdrawal. They wouldn't be able to, they would be dealing with this really intense pain. While being treated for an infection, they were worried that they would be judged by doctors. So stigma and shame and the specter of withdrawal really plays a lot into kind of the decisions people are making around their health.
And then the person's even sicker by the
yes.
time they get
oh,
to
yeah. If to, you to if you ER wait, it gets worse. Go. Obviously,
sure. So. Let's talk about stigma for a moment. Jose Benitez, who's head of Prevention Point, we've had him on here before, mm-hmm. Public Health Organization for People in Addiction, says stigma is a huge factor in the opioid crisis. In your reporting, what have you heard, Aubrey, from people who use about stigma and how it might prevent them from moving forward?
Yeah, I think, people feel ashamed of what's kind of happened to them, and you know,
and the way people look at them,
and the way people treat them. Yeah, I mean, it's a disease. They shouldn't feel ashamed. You know, they should seek treatment, and we should make it as easy as possible to seek treatment. But yeah, there's you know, there's this pervasive stigma against people who use drugs that contributes in so many ways to poorer health outcomes for them.
Kensington, ground zero of the crisis in Philadelphia, has gotten a lot of much-needed attention from the city. And as you referenced, I think, earlier, the overdose rate was down. Was it 23% last year?
Yes, in Kensington.
Okay. But other neighborhoods which are struggling with opioid abuse, not so much. As a matter of fact, as you report, Aubrey, the 19148 zip code in South Philly saw an increase of 20% in deaths last year. Why is this, and is there enough access outside Kensington to harm reduction services?
Yeah, South Philly saw an increase from 44 deaths to 53 deaths in the last year. And yeah, South Philly is a lot different than Kensington in terms of what the crisis looks there and like there. And in terms of, you know, kind of the vibe of the neighborhood, there's a lot of similarities, you know, kind of a working class area. Yeah, I think in general, it's there's not as much access to harm reduction services in South Philly at all as there is in Kensington. There's a mobile syringe exchange van that comes down a couple times a week. But I think one of the most shocking statistics for me reporting on this last year was that in 2017, 75% of overdose deaths in Philadelphia were occurring in private homes. So the crisis that we see in Kensington is the most visible aspect of the crisis, but people are dying all over the city. And these are people who are not necessarily on the street in Kensington. Yeah. They're, you know, people who might be functional, but, you know, still suffering and still risking an overdose.
Yeah. Yeah. And City Health Commissioner Thomas Farley has referenced this, that, you know, you've got people who might be injecting once a day and holding down a job. How does the city, what do you know of the city's efforts to try to address this hidden aspect of the problem?
It's really tough because it's hard to figure out where these people are. I know that there are harm reductionists working in South Philly to try to, you know, find people and reach out to people, you know, just through like word of mouth, you know, community ties. It's a pretty tight-knit place. But there's also a citywide campaign trying to get people to start using buprenorphine, which is it's a medication assisted opioid drug. It's basically an opioid combined with naloxone, and it helps people, you know, kind of curb cravings, get through the day without feeling like they need it, but obviously it's not.
And perhaps function?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Function, go to work, you hold down a job, and at the same time, hopefully wean them away from the stuff that could kill
That's
them.
That's the plan.
Yeah. More fallout from the opioid crisis. Philadelphia is currently contending with an outbreak of hepatitis A, declared a public health emergency. You talked about hepatitis a little bit earlier. As the Inquirer reports, there are usually fewer than 6 cases of hepatitis A in any one year in the city. This year, there are over 150. This is being attributed to the high level of public defecation in streets of neighborhoods like Kensington, which are really hard hit by the crisis. Do we know how the city is meeting this challenge, Aubrey?
Yes, they are thinking about opening public bathrooms in the area, which had been kind of controversial in the past.
How come?
Just because people had been worried that this would encourage people to stay on the street in Kensington, but there's not really, I mean, from a public health perspective, having people defecate on the street is obviously the worst option. So
let's get to the issue of supervised injection sites. Mayor Kenney is back from Canada, where he toured some sites in Toronto and Vancouver. What did he find, Aubrey Whelan?
Yes. So he, at a press conference last week that was unrelated to the visit, he mentioned it a little bit. He said that he supports the concept, but he kind of needs a public safety plan to surround this, like for what's going to happen around the site. And that's sort of what city officials have been saying for the last couple months in the wake of a lot of community discussion about what a site would mean in Kensington.
Has he elaborated on what public safety looks like?
Not really. yeah, they're still sort of developing it. He did, in fact, he wrote a friend of the court brief, you know, in the case, to the federal case that's trying to get a supervised injection site open.
Yeah.
So.
Well, as you report, there was concern that such a site could make drug dealing in any one area worse. Yeah. This is probably, I would assume, guessing, we don't have the facts, that a public safety plan would perhaps involve more police officers.
Yes. There have been some studies about how crime changes in an area around a safe injection site. I believe in Canada, the one of the findings was that their crime didn't increase, but it didn't decrease either. Hmm. So it pretty much stays the same. But yeah, it's hard to tell, especially as Mayor Kenney noted. You know, there's a lot of social services and more like federal state cohesion around the sites in Canada than there would be here. Philly would pretty much be going it alone. So
let's get a bit of backstory on the federal case that you'd mentioned. Earlier this summer, U.S. Attorney William McSwain asked a federal judge to determine the legality of supervised injection sites. There is a federal lawsuit against Safe House, the nonprofit which would open the Philly site. Judge Gerald McHugh has scheduled what's called an evidentiary hearing for later this month. Do you know what we might find out here during this hearing?
Yes. So that hearing is focused entirely on how a site would operate. So the Safe House has put out like a frequently asked questions section on its website where they try to kind of lay out exactly how things would go down. And we do have some models on how sites operate in Canada, but also there's a few secret sites operating in the United States right now. There's been a little bit of research done on them. So there are definitely models from around the country on how these would work. But yeah, we would hear how one would work in Philly.
So it's just an evidentiary hearing. We don't expect a thumbs up or a thumbs down.
No. And there's another hearing in September that is focused on the Controlled Substances Act and how it would apply to a safe house.
Yeah. Well, continuing with the refresher, why does William McSwain say a supervised injection site is illegal?
He believes that it is against a section of the Controlled Substances Act called the colloquially called the crack house statute.
Okay.
So it's a you know, 80s, 90s era law that was basically designed to stop people from like operating quote unquote crack houses. It, you know, places where drugs were manufactured, distributed, you know, sold, people could come in and use. So that's the, he believes that like the that a supervised injection site would be kind of equivalent to that,
yeah,
to at least under the law. So,
what does Safe House say?
Safe House says that it's a public health measure designed to stop a tide of overdoses, and that the Controlled Substances Act was never intended to apply to public health measures like that.
And there has been neighborhood pushback to a supervised injection site in the Kensington area, along with support.
Yes.
So you get a mixed bag. People are, you know, I'm not sure how they feel about it.
Yeah, I think, it's, I mean, one of the things about Kensington and their feelings about the supervised injection site is, you know, obviously they're the neighborhood hardest hit. There's a lot going on there just in terms of just of what you can see on the street, just, you know, people injecting, people buying.
But there was some improvement in the last year regarding overdose. Deaths.
Oh yes, yeah,
so,
yeah.
Little bit of hope.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, the neighborhood. I think part of it is that, and neighbors have told me that they're sort of tired of Kensington being sort of the repository of all the city's drug use and drug problems. They feel like, and I wrote about this earlier this year, that like at opening a site might be like kind of giving up. Like, all right, drug use is here to stay, drug dealing is here to stay.
Yeah.
But Safe Houses has said that the plan, or at least the ideal, would be to open multiple sites. So.
The Pew Charitable Trusts conducted a survey of hundreds of Philadelphians this spring and found that a significant number of people, Aubrey Whelan, know someone who's died from opioid abuse, nearly a third?
Yeah, nearly 3 in 10 Philadelphians know someone who's died of an opioid overdose or from opioid use.
And white respondents are more likely to know someone who's died from opioids than black or brown respondents, but the latter groups weren't far behind in numbers.
No. And I think that's a really under-reported aspect of the crisis is that yeah, it generally tends to affect white people more often, but in black and brown communities, opioid addiction is still a problem. It's on the rise nationally. And yeah, we kind of ignore it at our peril.
Oh. You recently took a look at A&E's TV reality series called Intervention, which this year is set in Kensington. I haven't had a chance to take a look at it, but as you write, the show follows people in active addiction through their daily lives, then stages an intervention with family members, stirring charges that it sensationalizes the lowest moments of a person's life for TV ratings. Tell us more.
Yeah, so it premiered last week. The season's focusing entirely on Philly and the Philly region. And a lot of harm reductionists and advocates in the city are really not happy about the way even just the trailer, because I spoke to them before the show premiered, the trailer kind of portrayed Philly as this, you know, dangerous, you know, drug-ridden place full of despair and misery and, you know, all these close-ups of people injecting heroin, and it was just very, like, very intense. And a lot of advocates feel that, like, this is just not the way to show addiction, not the way to show recovery, that it's, you know, it's kind of targeting people who are not in a great space.
It's supposed to offer its subjects help in the form of some sort of intervention.
Yes, it does. And the treatment that they get is free. It's like donated by various treatment centers from around the country. But the advocates that I spoke to were also a little bit concerned about that, because obviously not everybody can afford that kind of treatment. They can't afford many insurance plans won't even cover the minimum 90-day stay that intervention sends people on, and so it's kind of not, they feel like it's not a accurate picture of the state of treatment, recovery, addiction.
But at the same time, there's an entertainment factor here that might be squirm worthy.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I mean, especially watching it in previous years before, like, they started doing these kind of, they've been focusing for the last 2 years on, you know, like, one city. Last year they did Atlanta, this year it's Philly. But before it was one person an episode, and you know, a lot of the people who ended up on that show kind of became sort of like memes in like a, you know, in a very voyeuristic way. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it continues.
Yeah. Aubrey Whelan, thank you so much for joining us once
thank
again
you.
For Radio Times. Aubrey Whelan reports on the opioid crisis for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Up next, on a much lighter note, we take a look at the Eagles with the Inquirer's Mike Sielski. Stay with us. You are listening to Radio.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Believe it or not, football season is upon us. The Eagles had their first preseason game Thursday night, and even though these games technically are meaningless, this one was meaningful in that backup quarterback Nate Sudfeld broke a wrist and is expected to be out for some time. On top of that, the Birds lost to the Titans 27-10, although it is preseason and most of the starters were on the sideline. But still, a shaky beginning, and hopefully, especially with Sudfeld's injury, not an indication, a harbinger of things to come. Any thoughts, send them along or email radiotimes at whyy.org, or you can tweet us at whyyradiotimes. Mike Sielski, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, joins us now to share some observations. How are you, Mike?
Doing well, Mary. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. So, you know, with Sudfeld's injury, the thought was already?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit in that. You know, the Eagles, in a way, kind of have, and their fans in particular, I think, understand that the backup quarterback position is particularly important in the NFL nowadays. I mean, let's face it, if they didn't have a terrific one 2 years ago in Nick Foles when Carson Wentz got hurt, they wouldn't have won the Super Bowl. And even last year after Wentz got hurt, Foles was able to get them to the, you know, divisional round of the playoffs. So I understand why fans and people who follow the team would look at the Sudfeld injury and say, oh boy, you know, this could be a very problematic and big issue for the team. But the fact is, he's the timetable that he's going to be out with this broken bone in his left hand suggests he's only going to be out of the lineup about 6 weeks. That would put his return, you know, 2 or 3 weeks into the regular season. And so as long as Carson Wentz doesn't get hurt within those first couple of games,
well,
they can survive. Yeah, fair point. But they can survive, you know, as long as they need to without Sudfeld.
Yeah, and it could have been worse. Sudfeld's throwing arm is his right and not his left.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, tell us about the backups, because, of course, this is the headline now. You know, Wentz is injury prone, knock on wood, you know, for the 2019 season. So, as you mentioned, you know, it's really important to have, a good backup. Cody Kessler is in. He played for the Browns and the Jaguars. What do you think?
Well, he has 17 games of NFL experience. He was not terrible and has not been terrible as an NFL quarterback. But he's also probably not someone you would regard as a feasible long-term starter in the league. He's not particularly tall. He's only about 6 foot, 6 foot one. His one particular strength as a quarterback is that he's very accurate with his passes, but he doesn't have as strong an arm as either Carson Wentz or Nate Sudfeld. And at present, his backup, Kessler's backup, is a rookie out of Northwestern named Clayton Thorson, who had a really, really rough game Thursday night against the Titans. Mm-hmm. He threw 9 passes and only completed 2 of them and threw an interception and had some open receivers that he missed badly. And Thorson really hasn't had a very good training camp. So, again, while I think the Eagles are going to, you know, you can look at the situation and say, okay, this is not ideal, I don't think they're going to acquire another quarterback between now and the start of the season. I think they're content to kind of roll with Kessler. I think the bigger question is whether Thorson even makes the team, because as I said, he's been struggling so much in camp that I think there are really legitimate questions about whether he's a viable NFL quarterback.
Yeah, I think Mike, Peterson, Coach Doug Peterson, has indicated he's not going for another backup right now, but some are saying, why not look at Colin Kaepernick?
Yeah, Colin Kaepernick hasn't taken an NFL snap in going on 3 years. And if you want to get off the field and into some socio-racial political issues, you know, Kaepernick and one of his most outspoken ally in the NFL when it comes to these sorts of issues of social justice and things like that, safety Eric Reed, both have had public, you know, criticism and tete-a-tetes with Eagle safety Malcolm Jenkins. They've basically called him a sellout to the cause of racial justice. And so the idea of bringing Kaepernick into that locker room, you know, apart from all the strictly football ramifications of it, which I don't think, you know, I don't think it makes sense to add him at this point. I think that the dynamic away from the field is one that the Eagles are going to want to avoid.
How much of quarterback Carson Wentz do you think we'll see during the preseason? Next to nothing?
Yes. I would be surprised if you saw him more than a series or two, and I might even be surprised if we see him that much. The trend in the league nowadays amongst kind of the younger, more forward-thinking coaches is that, look, you know, in the risk-reward, you know, balancing, the risk of getting a franchise quarterback such as Wentz hurt or even, you know, one or more very valuable offensive players at other positions is just too great. And the work that these guys are getting done in practice, you know, is to these coaches as valuable as anything they're going to see during a preseason game. Because remember, Mary, you know, the defense that's going to play against Wentz or, you know, really any defense for any team in the preseason is going to be so basic and so vanilla that it might actually be more challenging for a team to face its own defense, which can scheme against them and, you know, present them with scenarios that might actually challenge them in practice as opposed to what's happening in these preseason games where most coaches just want to get out of there with all their best players intact.
Well, and yeah, the defense could be more, you know, dangerous. I mean, apparently Sudfeld's injury didn't have to happen.
No, he was thrown to the ground. It should have been a late hit penalty, and it wasn't called. And exactly, that's kind of like what happened with Sudfeld. You know, if Doug Peterson wasn't already thinking, well, I don't know that I'm going to play Carson in all this preseason, you know, that sequence should have told him, you know, Carson's not going to even put his pads on for one of these 4 games. We're going to get his work in practice and make sure he's ready for that first regular season game against the Washington Redskins.
Well, Mike Sealy, of course, you know, the next preseason game Thursday, I think it's in Jacksonville. So anyone hoping for a Carson Wentz, Nick Foles matchup, even at least for a couple minutes, is likely to be disappointed.
Very much so. You know, it's funny. I remember last year, right around this time, the Eagles opened their preseason against the New England Patriots. And, you know, you see these same sort of storylines crop up, you know, here comes Nick Foles into Foxborough to face the team that he beat, and Tom Brady's going to want to beat the Eagles. And the reality is, it's a preseason game. These guys, you know, they just want to get their work in, if they're going to get their work in at all. They don't care about these kind of narratives that we in the media and fans kind of drum up for what is really just kind of a meaningless exhibition.
But during the regular season, Eagles and Jaguars don't meet at all, right? Or am I wrong about that?
No, that's correct.
That's disappointing.
So you're going to have to, find the nearest, Jacksonville Jaguars fan bar somewhere in the Philadelphia area to watch Nick Foles if you're a particularly big Foles fan.
With the risk for injury, Mike, does the NFL really even need preseason? And is there any chance owners will agree to cut the number of games once again? It used to be six, now it's four, right?
Yeah, I think, there would be widespread support among the players for such a thing. The problem, such as it is that the owners see this as an easy revenue stream, and they're obviously reluctant to turn it off. So, and what they're lobbying for and actually proposed earlier this summer is expanding the regular season to 18 games, which was shot down summarily by the NFL Players Association. But I imagine something along these lines is going to happen, where if they, at some point, these two sides, the Players Association and the owners, are going to agree, okay, we'll cut the preseason. Maybe we will expand the number of playoff teams teams that can make the playoffs and therefore expand the playoffs. I think eventually they'll probably get to the point where you expand a regular season, because there is just so much hunger for NFL football and so much money to be made that it seems an inevitability. And I think the question then becomes, okay, how do the details get worked out? How big a slice of the pie do the players get? Because, especially given, the injury risks and, the increased knowledge about head injuries and concussions and things like that, they're going to have to get some serious give backs from the owners in order to agree to add two more games to the regular season, I think.
Let's take a look at training camp, preseason. Who's healthy? Who's injured? The starters from last year. How does it look, Mike?
From what I've seen in practice, I think this team looks very, very good. They seem to be, Peterson seems particularly, focused on kind of managing guys' workloads. I think that's the key for any sort of team. If you look at what happened to the Eagles last season, I think in total, they had the third most games missed to injury for any team in the NFL. And they were still able to make that late season push to get in the playoffs. They were able to win a playoff game on the road. They made so many, additions and ostensible improvements over the offseason, adding a wide receiver like DeSean Jackson, adding depth on the defensive line. You're getting back a healthy Carson Wentz. He is not playing. He does not have a knee brace on at this point. I think it's a bit of a fallacy to say that he is injury prone. Each of these injuries has been kind of in and of itself. It's not as if the same injury keeps repeating over and over again, and it's a chronic problem. He looks terrific in practice.
Okay.
I think this is a team that can compete for the Super Bowl again, without question.
So on paper, they look terrific, but as you write, terrific teams don't always do so well with the pressure they then naturally face.
Yeah, to me, I think that's the question. I think it's something that's kind of endemic to Philadelphia. It's hard for athletes and teams not to let that expectation kind of seep in. We as a fan base and a media contingent, I think, do very, very well when a team, in a way, kind of comes out of nowhere, so to speak, a team that's we think is going to be good but turns out to be much better than anyone imagined. If you think about the 2008 Phillies that won the World Series, or you think about that Eagles Super Bowl team in 2017, that was kind of this euphoric wave that everyone was happy to ride, because it played into the underdog mentality of the city. I think this situation is a little different because expectations are so high. I wonder how much people are really going to enjoy the season if the Eagles are good, and how much of it is just going to be this feeling of, okay, if they don't get to the Super Bowl and they don't win it, that anvil is going to fall from the sky and land on our heads like it does in every Looney Tunes cartoon, to Wile E. Coyote. And I think that's, you know, that pressure can start to seep in a little bit.
He's a metaphor for the Philadelphia sports fan, huh?
Yeah,
Wiley.
You know what? Yeah. I don't know if I'd say Wiley, but I definitely would go with the falling anvil or save from the sky.
So how do the Eagles put the dog masks on, at least mentally? You know, that famous picture of them heading to the Super Bowl. You know, as they were on their march, because they were the underdogs.
Yeah, you know, I think that any athlete can find anything out there as motivation. You know, and I think all it takes is a couple of, you know, national sports TV personalities saying that, I don't know if Carson Wentz can stay healthy, or I don't know, maybe the Dallas Cowboys are the better team in the NFC East, and these guys will find it and see it and tack it up inside their locker or put it on a billboard, you know, or you know, whatever you want to call it, whatever, however you want to post it for motivation, they will find it and they will use it. So, you know, unless every single football fan in America is saying the Eagles are going to win the Super Bowl and they're awesome, these guys will find some small slight and use it to their motivational advantage.
Okay. Well, you know, Mike Sielski, you did some fun people profiles lately. You talked to kicker Jake Elliott about fear of the double doink. You want to refresh us here? The Bears, Cody Parkey, who I think is now looking for work.
Yeah, that's right. Well, last season in the Eagles playoff win of the Bears, I think everybody remembers that Cody Parkey, who had kicked for the Eagles and was now kicking for the Bears, missed a potentially game-winning field goal at the end of the game, a 43-yarder that hit the upright and bounced down and hit the crossbar and then bounced away and was no good. And I talked to Jake Elliott, the Eagles kicker, who has made some tremendously important kicks, particularly during their Super Bowl run, just about that. The nature of his job, which to me is fascinating, you know, that you have everybody looking at you all the time. You know, you have to do this one specific thing. You have to kick the ball through the uprights, and if you don't do that, you're a failure. And, you know, as one of his teammates told me, it's not 50% physical and 50% mental. It's 90% mental.
Sure.
And 10% physical. And that to me just fascinates me, particularly in the light of football itself, which is such a physically demanding sport, and that position, kicker, might be the most mentally demanding one of all.
He reached out to Parkey, didn't he?
He did. He sent him a couple of text messages, talked to him over the phone. Kickers in the NFL are a very tight fraternity. I mean, they're, by nature, I think, kind of idiosyncratic, and, you know, they know what all of them go through. You know, all of them have missed a kick at some level. And you're in that locker room, and you're the smallest guy in the locker room, and all these other guys are out there putting their bodies on the line every single play, and then you trot on the field, and if you don't do your job, yeah, boy, that can be a tough dynamic to have to look those guys in the eye and say, sorry, fellas, I know you laid it all out there, and I couldn't do my part. So I think that's something that these guys live and perform with every day, and as I said, it's pretty demanding.
You also caught up with Zach Ertz, who, as you write, will be the best tight end in Eagles history. Is he on pace to eventually earn an induction into the Hall of Fame?
I think he is. You know, I think he came along at exactly the right time. In this era of football, it used to be that tight end was regarded as a position that you had to be a terrific blocker, you know, almost a sixth offensive lineman. Nowadays, the position has become one where you know, teams are looking for guys who are big and fast and strong, but who have great hands and can catch passes downfield. And Ertz was exactly that kind of player when the Eagles drafted him in 2013. And his career has just, you know, taken off since then. And I think people forget, you know, he scored the game-winning touchdown in the only Super Bowl that the Eagles won. And he is their single-season record holder for receptions in a season. He set that last year. And as long as he stays healthy, I think he's going to be on pace to, you know, put up statistics that rival any sort of tight end who's in the NFL Hall of Fame. I think it's just a matter of him not getting hurt.
Okay, first regular season game is against Washington at home, September 9th. And Washington's looking for a quarterback, who is the quarterback? Because Alex Smith is out.
Well, it's
I almost said
Cody Kessler. It's I'm drawing a blank. Well, they drafted Dwayne Haskins,
We'll see.
My gosh. The guy was on the mic. He was out of Ohio State. He threw 50 touchdown passes last year. Their starters, the gentleman who led the Vikings to the NFC Championship game 2 years, Case Keenum. Excuse me. I can't believe I drew a blank on that. Case Keenum is probably going to start for the Redskins.
All right. Well, stay tuned. And Mike, as always, so great to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Mary.
All right, Mike Sielski, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Don't forget to follow us on social media. Check out our podcast. Simply head to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, thank you so much for listening to Radio Times.